But sometimes it's the,
The meeting will come to order, please. And Representative O'Driscoll, have you looked over the minutes?
I will have in a moment.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Moves the minutes of January 25th. Is there any discussion? Are there any corrections? Seeing none, hearing none. Everyone in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. Today we are privileged to hear a presentation from both Minsky and the University of Minnesota. We have in our presence Scott Olson, who is Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs at Minsky, and Craig Schoenecker, who is the System Director for Research, and then from the University, Peter Radcliffe and John Kellogg. One is the Executive Director of Planning and Analysis, so we'll learn a lot from him, and the other is from the Office of Institutional Research. He probably coordinated the whole project. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee, and I'm not sure how you want to do this. If this is tag team, just be sure that you identify yourselves when you speak, that you speak into that microphone, and again, welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. And thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota, and thank you for your commitment to our students. This is very important. I'm Scott Olson. This is Craig Schoenecker. This is Peter, and this is John. So as we go down, that's who we are. We're happy to take questions as we go, and you should have already received this report, which is what we'll be referencing. What the report...
Excuse me, yes. Mr. Olson, but I don't know if everyone received that report. Did you bring any extras?
Yeah,
they're in they're in your packets. I'm sorry. I was thinking in mail. You know, I get everything in the mail, so thank you. Go ahead.
Excuse me, Chair. What this report looks at are the public systems in Minnesota, so that would be Minsky and the U of M, reporting to the school districts. And we give a summary to the Department of Ed, and we give detailed information to each of the school districts about what's going on there. The graduates that are included in this would be those who graduated from Minnesota public high schools and enrolled in a Minnesota public college or university and took one or more developmental courses within the first 2 years of having graduated from high school. So this would not include, for example, a student who may have graduated from Blake. It would not include a student who, for example, went to Carleton. It would not include a student who came to the University of Minnesota from Chicago, and it would not include a student who had waited, say, 5 years after high school before going to college. So those aren't in the numbers. The information that's reporting is the extent and the content of the developmental education that they're taking and the academic performance that proceeded from that. The first set of data we'd like to show you is what's been happening over time with these numbers. So what this chart shows you is the increasing percent of public high school graduates enrolled in public higher education. So these are those students who went to public high school, who then went on to public higher education in Minnesota, went to the U or went to Minsky. And what you'll see is, the good news is, over time, that number's been going up. What this means is a higher percentage of our high school graduates from our public high schools are going on to higher ed, from about 46% in the year 2000 to 53% in 2008. Minnesota's going to need more and more college-prepared students for the economy of the future. I think we all know that. So what you'll see in the chart is that the percentage of that population that is going to the University of Minnesota has essentially remained the same over that period of time. A slight increase in the number of students who are going to the state universities, but you'll see a significant growth in the number of students that are going to the state colleges. A little later, we'll loop back to this, but as we're serving that particular population, that, you know, these are students who in the past would not have gone on to higher education. And so that does affect what we need to do when they arrive at our door. I'll turn it over to Craig to take the next slide.
For the record, I'm Craig Schoenecker. This slide reports on the percentage of these recent high school graduates who are taking one or more developmental courses within 2 years after graduating. And the blue bars represent the average for that whole group of graduates that came to public higher ed. So we've gone from about a third of them back in 2000 to now 40% of those students are taking one or more developmental courses. The line graphs show the percentages within each of the sectors. So the lowest line graph is the percent of students going to the University of Minnesota who are taking developmental courses, down from about 15% back in 2000 to just 2% now. The middle line is for the state universities in our system, where it's been, it was trending up a bit, but now is trending down, so that they're at about 22% of those students take one or more developmental courses. And then the growth really has been at our two-year state colleges, where we've gone from 44% to now 54% of the recent high school graduates are taking developmental courses within 2 years. A significant proportion of this developmental course taking is really just a single course, and most commonly it's mathematics. We'll get into a little bit of detail on that in another slide, but this graphic shows the percentage of students in each of these three sectors who took, of those that took developmental courses, what percent took only one course. And so you can see statewide, the red bars indicate that we've actually seen a decline in the percentage of students taking only one course, down from 56% in 2000 to 47% in the most recent graduating cohort that we've tracked. But at the University of Minnesota, the blue bars, we're now up to 98% of those students that take a developmental course are taking only one course. At the state universities, we've seen a little bit of a decline from 91% down to 84%, and at the colleges, we're seeing a decline as well, where almost half of the students back in 2000, 47%, were taking one developmental course. We're now down to 41% among those students that come to our two-year colleges. This graphic illustrates the distribution of the developmental course taking for those students that take courses. And the red segment represents mathematics. You can see that for the state universities and for the University of Minnesota, the vast majority of the developmental courses that students are taking are in mathematics. At the state colleges, on the other hand, a little bit less than half of the courses are in mathematics. Significant portion of the courses are in writing and in reading, and then a small segment in other disciplines like English as a second language and study skills. And this graphic is just illustrating developmental ed within the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So the pie chart shows the distribution of our full year equivalent enrollment. And as you can see, the vast majority, almost 94% of our FYE, is in lower division, upper division, or graduate courses. About 3,500 FYE, or 2.3% of the total, the red slice there, is developmental course taking by recent high school graduates. So this group of students we're profiling, those developmental courses represent about 2% of all of our full year equivalent enrollment. And then the developmental courses that we offer to other students who aren't recent high school graduates is about 4% of our total FYE. So about a third of the developmental courses that we offer are for recent high school graduates, and about two-thirds are for older adult students. And then wanted to give you some sense of the expenditures that we would attribute to those developmental courses for recent high school graduates. And our estimate is that we spend $11.6 million, this is in fiscal year 2009, out of a total of $627 million. This would be expenditures for direct instruction. So it's the expenditures in the classroom, faculty salaries and benefits, supplies, equipment, and expenses for classroom instruction. So really just under 2% of that spending on instruction we would attribute to developmental courses for recent high school graduates. And those dollars would have been funded approximately one half by students' tuition and one half by state appropriations. I wanted to provide a little context on the readiness of students for college. And so this is a totally different analysis done by ACT. ACT has done some work over the years with a significant number of colleges and universities in order to determine what scores on the ACT assessment would correlate to readiness for college-level courses in each of these disciplines. And so these graphics are based on the 2010 students who took the ACT in Minnesota. And so what we see for English, for example, is that 21% of the Minnesota ACT test takers in 2010 were judged by ACT standards to be not ready for a college-level writing course or English course. The national comparison there is 34%. So across the board, Minnesota ACT test takers are more likely to be ready for college-level courses across these disciplines than is the national average for all ACT test takers. I think an important context to keep in mind is ACT test takers are not going to be exactly aligned with the students we're reporting on as recent high school graduates. The students that come to our college, by and large, don't take the ACT test. Those colleges are open door. A high school diploma is what's required for admission. And so those students who we see are more likely to need developmental courses are not represented very significantly in this ACT test-taking population. But what you see is in mathematics, 40% of Minnesota ACT test takers were deemed to be not ready for a college-level math course, and the comparison would be 57% of nationwide ACT test takers. In reading, it's about a third of Minnesota students not ready, as opposed to almost half nationwide. And then in biology, which they correlate with the ACT science subscore on the ACT assessment, fully 58% of students were judged not to be ready for a college-level biology course coming out of high school. And then the sort of the summary statistic is 65% of Minnesota test takers were not ready in one or more of these discipline areas for a college-level course. So that's kind of a external comparison that gives you context for the results we're reporting on Minnesota public high school grads.
Chair Erickson, back to me, Scott Olson. Some key points to take from this. One is that, as you might suspect, readiness for college varies by the college mission. So the University of Minnesota has become increasingly selective in who they admit over the years, and that's why you're seeing a lessening need there for remedial and developmental ed. Our community colleges, our technical colleges, are open access institutions, high school diploma only, and so they, as you would guess, have a higher need for students to have some additional work when they get there. Increased participation in higher education is likely a contributing factor to the increased need for remedial and developmental that you see in the report. More students are coming, and so more of this seems to be required. The system-wide standard scores for placement into college-level courses were implemented in fall 2008. What this means is that within the MinSCU system, all of our colleges now have a standard ACCUPLACER score that they use across them to place students into different remedial areas. So it's consistent across. And math, as you saw, is very much the biggest readiness issue that we have. That's the one where there's the least preparedness. A few things we are doing now to try to address this. The Minnesota P20 Education Partnership, that has a number of readiness initiatives, College and Career Readiness Initiative, the Developing Communication Campaign, which communicates back with parents and students about how to be ready for college, encouraging middle and high school students to take rigorous courses while they're there, strategies to close the STEM achievement gap, and something new this year, what's nicknamed SLEDS, the Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data System, that will allow us to track what students are taking and what it leads to downstream. This is an important project that's just kind of in its earliest stages. You may have heard about the Bush Foundation partnership with both the University of Minnesota, several state U's in the MinSCU system, as well as some of the private colleges in Minnesota. This is looking at teacher education and how can we improve teacher education to make sure that the teachers are coming out as best prepared as they can be so that the students are going to be successful. Within MinSCU, we have College Access and Opportunity Centers. We give funding to three large centers, and every one of our campuses has access and opportunity initiatives going on. We do placement testing. Some of our colleges are doing placement testing in partnership with the high schools right now. Probably a signature example would be the Minneapolis Public Schools working with MCTC as an example of how that's being done. We're expanding opportunities for high school students to complete rigorous courses in high school. This is PSEO. This is concurrent enrollment, where college and the schools, where students are able to challenge themselves more so in high school. And articulation of secondary and college career with technical programs, Perkins, is basically what that is. I'll turn it over to John and Peter at the U to talk about what they're doing.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. I'm Peter Radcliffe from the University of Minnesota. Although we don't do a large amount of FNIF developmental education directly at the University of Minnesota, college readiness is an important part of our research and outreach missions. So we're involved in a number of activities to try and help students be prepared for college. The umbrella for this is the College Readiness Consortium, which we started about 5 years ago. Our executive director, Ken Pickell, will be very happy to talk further about that if it was of interest to the committee. A couple of the main programs that we run there, we have Ramp Up to Readiness, which is a school-wide strategy for helping students be prepared academically, financially, for admissions. We've had about 4,000 students who have gone through that program. We also run the Minnesota Principals Academy, which is a training program for principals and charter school leaders to run school-wide initiatives to improve readiness. We've had about 200 principals who have been through that process. That's pretty much.
Chair Erickson, we'd be happy to take any questions that the committee has.
Yes, we already have a list of those who have questions. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Do we have any information on like the evaluation? Are the developmental courses successful, or I imagine they vary according to university or school particular ones, but do we have that type of information?
Chair Erickson.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Representative Crawford. We are doing some analysis currently. Our Board of Trustees, the Minsky Board of Trustees, has identified some questions around developmental education as a goal that they want to address this year, and so we do have a project underway that is looking at students that take developmental courses, profiling them, comparing them with students that don't, and how successful they are ultimately. And also in the Getting Prepared report, we did include some performance data, grade point averages, as of the end of that tracking period, comparing students that take developmental courses with those that don't. You see that the GPAs are slightly lower for students taking developmental courses, but by and large, the majority of those students are successful as they move through our system.
Mr. Schoennecker, you have your group has only done this report over a period of 3 years, 2 years, not yearly. Is that correct? Would you comment on how that might affect what you just said about following up?
Representative Erickson, we track and analyze and report on each high school graduating cohort. So you'll see in this most recent report, I think we're reporting on 5 or 6 groups of high school graduates. We submit that report, we send it out to all the school districts, to the State Department of Education every other year, but we are reporting on each of those groups of graduates and tracking them through the system to determine if they're taking developmental courses, what their academic success is.
So, Mr. Schoennecker, to what extent would you be able to prepare a report annually so that maybe we can track this a little bit more acutely?
Chair Erickson, certainly we could do that if that's the judgment of the committee that we would rather have more frequent reporting. That's certainly something we can do.
Thank you. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, this is for anybody to answer. I know a lot of the initiatives sound really good. I'm just wondering how much communication there has really been between the teachers in K-12 and the staff at the higher ed institutions so that they can build this alignment and communicate. And then I have a second question to follow.
Mr. Schoennecker.
Chair Erickson, Representative McFarland. I can't speak comprehensively about communication between high school teachers and college and university staff, but I can describe a couple of instances that I think get at your question. Minneapolis Tech Community and Technical College and the Minneapolis School District have a very close relationship. The college is doing testing of sophomores and juniors in high school to give them early feedback about their readiness. There's work with high school teachers and college faculty in the disciplines. The other example is Minnesota State Community and Technical College in northwestern Minnesota is one of the centers of excellence for access and opportunity within our system. And they have developed it was initially started with the English faculty at the college and high school English faculty from the area, developed a joint, a common assessment of writing. And so they now have a system whereby students can actually submit writing that they have done, writing samples, have them scored by this standard rubric, and then students will get feedback about how well they're prepared for college-level writing. And they're expanding that out to other disciplines as well. So that is one where we've had very long-standing work between high school faculty and college faculty.
Mr. Olson.
Chair Erickson, Representative McFarland, there is a recognition by the P20 partnership that communication between higher ed and schools, parents, students could be better. So that is one of the things the P20 partnership is looking at and is working on now.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would hope that they would continue to do it, not just talk about it, but actually do it. The other thing is I'm wondering what input or what communication is there in developing the test for assessment in the higher ed institutions. I'll bring a case example. In 2000, my daughter was admitted to Minsky school, took the test, did not pass the math test. I went back to our high school teacher. We had a new curriculum. The teacher said, oh, we never taught that chapter in our school. Well, when come to find out, my daughter never needed the skills that were required for that assessment test to graduate from college. So, they suggested she take remedial. She did not do it, and she graduated. I just wonder how much of it appears to be, it sometimes appears to a consumer that it's a money-making issue. And can you respond to that?
Mr. Olson, you want to try that first?
Chair Erickson, Representative McFarland. Did you say 2000?
Mm-hmm.
Did
yes.
I hear that right? One of the things that has happened is a standardized use of the ACCUPLACER test, which is a national test, so we can actually see that it correlates with national standards and across all the colleges. So that might be one thing that would have changed since your daughter would have been test-taking and colleges perhaps had different instruments they were using, and that may have led to some inconsistencies. That would be one thought.
Mr. Schoenecker.
Chair Erickson, Representative McFarland, under the auspices of the P20 Council, there's been a fair amount of work that has been done in developing high school graduation standards in the various disciplines, and we have also had college and university faculty in mathematics in particular, I know, participating in that effort to try to align high school graduation standards with college admission standards in the various disciplines.
Madam Chair,
follow-up.
Just a comment. I would hope that when our students graduate from school that they should have what they need to go to college without having to go through this. So,
I have a question for you, Mr. Schoenecker, or Mr. Olson, or the other gentleman. Do you know how many high schools are using the ACCUPLACER before you probably give it to your students? Mr. Schoenecker.
Representative Erickson, I don't have numbers on that. I know that at least half of our colleges are partnering with some of their feeder high schools to do that testing, and actually had asked for some additional data on that, so we may be able to provide firmer numbers on the extent of that activity.
Thank you, because in my conversations with superintendents, I know they're concerned about, you know, what this report says. Nevertheless, we want to also enable them to use an instrument so that they can be on top of things for their students, so that when they come to you, we're not spending this money or this time on remediation. We want our students to be ready. Next question, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Schoenecker, I'd like to follow up on Representative McFarland's discussion with you a little. I taught college prep courses in Edina schools for many, many years, and during that time there was hardly any communication between the college and universities and the secondary schools as to what the universities would want or the colleges would want. And I had discussed with some of university professors who had come to my class for guest lectures why their colleges accepted students who were not prepared to do college work. Many said that they felt sorry for them or felt that they needed to have a college degree, and so they were willing to do it. The other day, I think it was on the 20th, the executive director of Minnesota Business Partnership was here to testify, and I asked him that question, and he came out with a very blunt answer, which kind of shocked me, and I thought it was a little harsh, actually. But he said, the colleges really want the money. Now, this is a view, then, from the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I would just say that, you know, having been a teacher wanting to prepare my students as well as possible for college, if the colleges and universities simply said, these students you're sending us are not prepared to do college work, it would have the most revolutionary effect on parents, because many times parents want to see that their children get this high school diploma so they can get off to college. And they don't get into the minutia of what are these math requirements and writing requirements and so forth. So unless the colleges and universities really form a strong partnership with the secondary schools as these enrollments go up, with no discussion of who might benefit from a liberal arts college education versus technical college or these other kinds of things, this problem will escalate, I suspect. And the public's perception of public school and thereby it, their support for public education will continue to diminish, I think. So how would you respond to Mr. Well, I don't know if I should mention his name, but the director of Minnesota Business Partnership.
Mr. Schoenecker.
And my question to you.
Chair Erickson, Representative Benson. One point that I'd go back to is our state colleges, two-year colleges, are those open-door institutions where the high school diploma is the requirement. And so that's really where we're seeing the significant growth in the need for developmental ed. Our universities that are selective, that need is relatively smaller there. But in order for students to succeed in college or university, the, you know, kind of a firm basis for that is that they have the skills in mathematics, in reading, and in writing so that they're able to go into the college level courses and be successful. I think that's really the, you know, that's the view that our college and universities would have in terms of why they need to offer the developmental ed and ensure that students are prepared to be successful subsequently. And then the other piece of context would be, as we as we have been hearing for a number of years now, we need to be replacing the workforce with college-educated individuals coming into the workforce. And we need to, you know, we've seen some projections recently that Minnesota needs to have 70% of the workforce with some sort of college education by 2018. And so we do need to be bringing these students into higher ed, providing them with whatever developmental coursework they need in order to be able to try to respond to that demand for the workforce.
Just to
Representative Benson, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, here we are sitting in this Educational Reform Committee. We're seeking to find pathways to improve secondary education so that these young people who wish to apply to whatever college or university they might consider are going to be prepared. And I really think that the post-secondary people have a responsibility to assist the secondary schools to help prepare these kids. And even though I'm glad to see that we're talking 2-4% of the incoming freshmen needing this help, this is still an enormous amount of money. Money we could better spend at the secondary level. And so I don't know. I'm just not convinced that we can make the reforms we need in K-12 unless there's a more clear understanding on the part of the parents and students that they really have to buckle down in the K-12 system and not just be given a pass. We had a big debate about this on math standards, and the decision was to postpone it for a while on the grounds that we had not provided the kind of coursework necessary all the way through. And so the argument was, we'll wait a little while until that coursework is being presented in the lower grades so that these kids actually have an honest chance, or Representative McFarland's daughter gets that extra section in the math curriculum at her high school so that she can pass this test and not have to spend money on this developmental education, which I call makeup stuff. But anyway, I don't know. I'm just... I'm very happy that you're nice and that you let these people in, but it's not going to help us get education reform moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Olson wants to reply to that.
Chair Erickson, Representative Benson, I agree with you, and I think I'm pretty confident that just about everybody in our system agrees with you that public higher education in Minnesota has to be part of the solution to this challenge. So that's why President Brunix and Chancellor McCormick have been part of the P20 partnership. They go to every meeting, and that's why I'm sure their successors will continue that, and that's why I think communication between higher ed and K-12 is critical and why we're working so hard on it. I wouldn't disagree with anything that you said there. In terms of the comment that your colleague made, I've worked in higher ed for 25 years. I have yet to meet anybody whose motivation for delivering remedial and developmental ed was to make money for the college. I'm not saying that's not out there. I just haven't personally had that experience of knowing anybody where that was their motivation. So I guess that would be my response to your original question.
There are lots of questions from members, but gentlemen, can you stay around? Because we have more questions, but we want to hear from Joe Nathan. Has some comments to make, and we also have a couple bills to hear in this committee before we adjourn today, so maybe we can reconfigure our presentation. So gentlemen, maybe you just want to stay in the stay close by for other questions while we hear Joe Nathan's response to your report. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nathan. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. I've been a public school teacher and administrator in this state, as well as a local PTA president and a member of the state board of the Minnesota PTA, also done a lot of research, and as some of you know from testimony yesterday and other conversations, we worked with the Cincinnati Public Schools over a period of 5 years. We were able to increase overall graduation rates in Cincinnati and to eliminate, not just reduce, but eliminate the graduation gap between white and African American kids. We also have helped to create some charter public schools in urban areas that exceed the state and local average in terms of the percentage of kids going on to some form of higher education. And graduating from high school. And for the last 40 years, literally, as a public school teacher, administrator in this state, researcher, PTA president, advocate, a person working for the last decade with the National Governors Association, a chief author of a report the National Governors Association published some years ago, we've been very interested in what works. We have tried to adopt the NOAH, that's N-O-A-H principle, the NOAH principle is no more prizes for predicting rain, prizes only for building arcs. So what we have tried to do in our work at the school, community, and policy level is to identify what works and learn from that and try to share and spread that. So a number of you said, what's happening with the contact between high schools and colleges? And for the last 5 years, we've been setting up meetings involving people from high schools and colleges to learn from each other. All the wisdom is not going one way. There are insights that high school teachers have that college faculty can use, and we have promoted two-way exchanges. So I also want to say briefly that the comments that I'm going to make reflect only my own views. They do not necessarily reflect those of McAllister College faculty, administration, or the Board of Regents. So we have been huge fans of this, and as some of you know, I write a weekly column that appears in about 20 newspapers around the state, including several represented around this table. And I've tried over the last decade to do a number of evaluations and assessments and secondary analysis of the data, and I'm going to briefly summarize several things and then say what it might mean for the state of Minnesota and for the Minnesota legislature, and most importantly for the schools and the students. So on the top half of this sheet that you have is selected data from the 2008-2010 Getting Prepared reports. One recommendation that I hope you'll consider is to, when this is done the next time, and I hope it's done within the next year, but if whenever it's done, whether it's 1 or 2 years from now, I hope that the next report will include data that shows trends. And you'll see in this piece of paper that I put together the 2008 and 2010 reports, because I think we want to know what's happening in the same schools. And we work with the National Governors Association and a number of governors, and many of them are very interested and complimentary of the fact that Minnesota has asked the state college and university system and the University of Minnesota to do this, and I want to commend those systems for working together to do this. So in brief, we have looked at what are the high schools around the state that have more than 40% of the kids going to some form of public post-secondary education and the lowest percentage of kids who are taking remedial courses. And we've actually gone to a number of those communities, interviewed people, and I'll talk a little bit in a minute about what we've found. But, for example, there's something really important happening in Chicago, Alberta. If you look toward the right-hand side, you'll see that 67% of the kids in the most recent report in Chicago, Alberta, went to a public college or university in Minnesota, and only 16% of them took a remedial course. Remember, the statewide average is 53% of the kids going to public college or university and 40% taking some form of remedial or developmental course. In Chicago, Alberta, it's not 53%, it's 67%. In Chicago, Alberta, it's not 40% of the kids having to take remedial course, it's 16. You can see that in Clinton Graysville, it's not 53% going on to public college, it's 51%, but it's only 19% who have to take a remedial course, and so on down there. You can see Minnewashta, 59% going on, only 21% of those kids having to take a remedial course. Piers, 60% of the kids going to a public college or university, and only 21% of the kids who go to a public college or university having to take remedial courses. So my hypothesis is there's something really important that's going on in those schools. We've also looked at free and reduced lunch, because at one point I presented this several years ago, and someone said, well, maybe those are rural communities that have that are much more affluent. So you'll see that they're right at the state average in terms of low income. And by the way, the state average of 37% is K through 12, and there's a slight underreport in many high schools because kids don't want to report that they're free and reduced lunch. In any case, you also can see that these are virtually all white schools. That's true. You can see that these are schools that have very low percentages of kids who are limited in English proficiency. That's why we tried to present a variety of information. That's absolutely true. So can every school in the state do exactly what these schools are doing? No. But there are some lessons to be learned, and I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. It's worth noting that we need to get down to Edina, which is 34% of the kids going on to some form of public post-secondary education, before we get to a suburban high school that ties some of these rural schools in terms of the percentage of kids taking remedial education. Now, this statistic needs to be carefully interpreted, and I discussed this on a local television station a couple years ago, and some Western Suburban Superintendents called a member of the University of Minnesota Board of Regents, and we had a very lively conversation at lunch. It is absolutely true that a number of the kids from Edina are going out of state or going to private colleges and universities. Absolutely true. This is not a total picture. There's no one statistic, whether it's SATs or the ACTs or graduation. This is no one statistic that tells you everything you need to know about a high school. Then I want to talk briefly about the trends and then say four or five things about what this might mean for the state of Minnesota and for the legislature. So what I tried to do was to look at the high schools in the communities that are represented around this table. So most of the high schools in most of the districts are represented around this table. Not everyone, but many of them. And in the case of Rochester, all three. In the case of Minneapolis and St. Paul, several of them. And what I tried to do in the bold was to say, there's something against the trend going on here. And again, I'll say a little bit about that, and then I'll make a few recommendations. First, the statewide trend, as the people from the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State College and University System said, the statewide trend is an increase in the number of kids who are going to public colleges and universities, and an increase in the number of kids who have to take remedial courses. That's clearly the trend. However, is it only because the kids, more kids are going to college because of the economic situation? I would say, based on our work with schools all over Minnesota, the answer is those are not the only reasons. The fact that it's difficult for many kids to find jobs. It's also because some kids are staying in state who might otherwise go out of state, or some kids are going to public colleges and universities who might otherwise go to private colleges and universities. So there's several things going on. But let's take a look at Brooklyn Center. Brooklyn Center increases the percentage of kids by 12 points between the last report, which covers 2003-2006. It increases by 12 points the percentage of kids who are going on to a public college or university in Minnesota, and only by 4 points are the percentage of kids who are having to take remedial courses. In Burnsville, that percentage increases by 6 points, the percentage of kids going on, and the percentage of kids who have to take remedial courses, developmental courses, stays the same. In Moundsview, Representative Greiling, I think, might be interested in this, and others. 43% to 47% an increase in the percentage of kids who are going to a public college, but a decline in the percentage of kids who have to take remedial courses. Just a handful of other examples. I've highlighted several where it's counterintuitive, and I wanted to mention in Minneapolis and St. Paul, recognizing that we have representatives from Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as Burnsville and Mora and Crystal and so on and so forth around the table. There's something interesting that's going on, and I don't know what it is, at Washburn High School in Minneapolis. You can see that they increased the percentage of kids by 12 from 67, this is on the back, from 67 to 49, to 79. Increased the percentage of kids who are going to a public college or university in Minnesota by 12 points, and the number of kids who are taking remedial courses or developmental courses actually declined by 1 point. Now, I don't know what's going on there, but it seems worth checking out. And we are, in fact, going to be doing some interviewing with people at Washburn. Same thing at Central, same thing at Highland. Increase in percentage of kids who are going on to some form of public college or university in Minnesota, and a decline, slight decline in the percentage. So it is possible, as all of you know, many of you have been in the legislature for 15, 20 years. Many of you are veteran policymakers on local school boards. State Teachers Union, you've looked at statistics. There are lots of different ways to interpret statistics. So here are my four interpretations. First, we need to look more carefully at schools that are counterintuitive. And yesterday, as you know, I suggested that the legislature might ask the Department of Education to take a look at schools that are showing improvements that are significantly greater than the statewide averages in academic achievement, in graduation rates, and this is another area. It seems to me that we need to identify schools, whether they're district or charter, that are making significant progress. Second of the four recommendations. My recommendation is that this report be done yearly, and or that it be done every 2 years for sure. It's just come out. It's 2010, but it's just come out. I know that the state colleges and state university systems have a lot of work to do, but this, it seems to me, is a really important report help us see if we're making progress. And so the second recommendation about the use of the report is that the next reports include some trend data such as this. It's in the computers. I know it takes work, additional work, but I think everybody would be better served by having trend data, not just here's the 2010 report, and you have to go back to the 2008 report, and you have to go back to the 2005 report. So the second recommendation is to include some trend data. The third recommendation is that I think that we need to do a much better job of encouraging more kids to take advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools, and PSEO courses. And here there is some progress, which I am not prepared to share in great detail today, but will be in the next month or so if the chair and the committee are interested. We have been working very actively with others And that certainly includes the University of Minnesota system and the Minnesota State College of University system, to encourage more kids to take dual enrollment courses. And as some of you recall, this was very controversial when post-secondary options was proposed in 1985. This, of course, it's now been a quarter century, and 100,000 kids have used that law plus. But equally important, high schools all over the state have adopted College in the Schools, Advanced Placement, International Baccalaureate. And the point is that from research in other states, it appears clearly that youngsters who participate in such courses do better, are more likely to graduate, are less likely to take remedial courses. So I'm going to be asking for the opportunity to come back and talk a little bit about this new report. But clearly, we have a success in this state, which is that we have more kids and more kids of color and more low-income kids taking AP, IB, International Baccalaureate, and College in the Schools. And that has come about quietly, but it has become about because there is a lot of collaboration going on. And I do want to commend the University of Minnesota system and the state college system, because both have been working very actively to establish more College in the Schools courses. And I think they deserve recognition and acknowledgement for that. And fourth, and finally, several of you have mentioned the critical importance of more conversation between high school and college faculty, and I want to emphasize it should not be just the college faculty doing workshops for the high school faculty, because many of the college faculty discovered when we did workshops together that high school faculty had some really intriguing ideas about how to teach things. So I am not just talking about what often happens, which is the high school faculty take a workshop from a college faculty person. I am talking about a true exchange of best practices. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. And Mr. Olson and Mr. Schennecker, maybe you want to return to the table. Representative Peterson, I think you have a question for Mr. Nathan. Is that correct?
Thank you. I was looking at the numbers here, Madam Chair and Mr. Nathan, these are really interesting figures. Did you figure the mobility of students into these figures at all? Because, if students have been in a district for most of their career, if it's a stable family, they've been in the career, that district, their chances are more likely. All the data says they're more likely to be able to not only graduate but also not have remedial courses. And if they're going from school to school to school, it's really hard sometimes for them to pick up all the kinds of credits and learning that they need to graduate. And I think that is an important piece of this, and I wondered if you'd done any looking at the mobility issue.
Mr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, no. Completely agree with what you said, but that was not a part of our analysis. And it may be that the legislature wants to include that as a part of that, but it is completely agree with what you said.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a lot of questions, but I won't ask them all because I don't want to get in trouble with my colleague, Representative Barrett, who's got a bill up pretty soon. But let me just very quickly for the... and I'm sorry for the gentleman from Minsky and the U of M. Very, very quickly, on the P20, it's a reference to the P20 that makes me ask this. Does each campus still use its own determination factor for placing students in developmental or remedial courses, or is there a uniform statewide determination for that now?
Thank you for that question, Representative Mariani. I'm just going to interrupt the answer for a second. University of Minnesota, would you like to return to the table? Maybe this question requires all of you to participate. Mr. Radcliffe and Mr. Kellogg, if you feel so inclined, one or the other, or both.
Madam Chair, I'm not looking for a long answer, just a quick yes or no would probably suffice at this point, because I do have a follow-up question.
Thank you. So, gentlemen, Mr. Schennecker.
Chair Erickson, Representative Mariani, within our system, all of the colleges are using the same placement testing, placement tests, and they're using the same cut scores for placement into college level or developmental courses. So that has been standardized. That's something we implemented in the fall of 2008. The universities do some ACCUPACER testing, but rely more heavily on using the ACT assessment to determine whether students are ready for college level or need developmental courses.
Mr. Radcliffe.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. Each one of our campuses does do their own tests, which we've done internally built. But we have a limited number of campuses and a fairly small number of students involved.
Follow-up, Representative Mariani.
Yeah, Madam Chair, ultimately this data for us and this end, I think is only going to be meaningful to the degree that we have a uniform system. I can develop all sorts of theories, sociological, psychological theories based on social cohesion models, on why certain students within certain communities might be referred to remedial, quote-unquote, remedial courses, and perhaps not in other areas where maybe there's a different kind of social cohesive environment. So I know the P20 is working on this. It sounds like they've made progress, actually, over the last few years, and I hope that that continues. And then, so, Madam Chair, I'll ask one more now, and then I'll stop.
Go ahead, Representative.
And then perhaps this is more for Mr. Nathan, but actually for the gentleman as well. You know, as I look at Joel's, Mr. Nathan's chart here, I still don't know who it is that's taking these remedial courses relative to some pretty important social SES factors. I can infer, you know, by the statewide that when you've got 8% LEP and 26% students of color, and that's, you know, there seems to be a correlation between that, you know, perhaps, and the 40% taking remedial, but I don't know that. I think that part of what we need to know is who are taking these courses, and in fact, what the trend of that is over time. Minnesota has a pretty proud history of paying close attention to students with special needs. We have a strong special ed community, a strong IEP. A reality for many of our students. We want those students to go to post-secondary as much as any other students. But what I don't know from any of this is whether there's any inference between that or limited English, for that matter, relative to this issue. And maybe they can comment very quickly, Madam Chair, but I think this is something we could follow up in the future.
Mr. Nathan.
Two quick comments, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani. First, we need more disaggregated data, unquestionably, and that would strengthen the report. That takes time and money, obviously, but I think that is a critical issue. Secondly, my apologies, but as these gentlemen noted, the number one area by far where we have kids taking remedial courses is in math, and many of you are aware of the challenges that occurred when Minnesota tried to resolve the issue of what students ought to know and be able to do in math, and obviously there's a moratorium on this. We work with districts and charters all over the state, and one of the things I hear constantly from the faculty is, well, the kids know they don't have to pass a math test in order to graduate. And I recognize there were complex philosophical, political issues and a recognition that there were challenges that were difficult to resolve. But I will tell you what teachers say to me all over the state, and I agree with them. We ought to try to resolve that this year so that it is clear to kids what they need to know and be able to do. And by the way, not just to get out of high school, but to get into a two-year program. I'm certainly not suggesting that everybody in the state is going to go to a four-year program. Lots of good jobs with two-year programs. But we need to have that state math, in my view, tied to what the ACCUPLACER and that level of expectation is.
Mr. Olson, are you able to tell this committee whether or not you and the University of Minnesota gives a report like this to the department every year? And if not, how frequently do you deliver this report? I mean, this is the public report, but do you report to the department?
Chair Erickson, we're able to report to you, to this committee, every year if you would like. We're willing to do that. The data that's reported is annual, and I'll defer to Dr. Schoenecker as to whether or not it's given to the Department of Ed annually or biannually.
Chair Erickson.
Mr. Schoenecker.
This report is actually prepared and submitted to the Commissioner of Education. The law that directs us to do this work says directs us to report a summary state-level report to the Commissioner of Education and then reporting to each school district on the experience of their graduates in public higher ed. So we have been doing this every other year, but reporting on each graduating cohort.
And gentlemen and members, I refer you to under Government Data Practices Subdivision 6 under 13.32 about reporting to school districts about the data. So we should probably all review that. Next question, Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I particularly want to thank the gentleman that just testified regarding the data getting prepared by school district. I think that that's an excellent, and I think that I know that the law requires to report to the school districts. I think this kind of information, to follow up on Representative Benson's concern, is that we need to get this information out to the public. Quite frankly, I am absolutely shocked that so many of our students need remedial education, as we even, you know, some of the schools that, whether it's Edina or some of the others, and I'm thrilled that some of these other schools are making progress, but even if it's 16%, and that is progressive, it's not good enough to get these children in. And I still have to wonder, going back to Representative McFarland's questions, why are we accepting kids in the schools? It was Charlie Weaver, by the way, who's the president of the business partnership, who made that comment, and I'm sure as a businessman that's his you know, that was his fallback answer on that, not knowing really what the reality is. But it doesn't, it to me, for the university to take that responsibility on by themselves doesn't make sense. I know you're charging an extra $11.6 million for remediation. Half of that goes to the students and half goes to the state. I would like to ask, I do have a question in here, and that is, of the half that's charged to the students, is that appropriated to all students in tuition, or is it just charged to the students who need the remediation? That's one question. And then the other one is, what part of state remediation pays for the other half? What part of your budget from the state pays for the other half?
Mr. Schennecker.
Chair Erickson, Representative Depke, the students are that are taking the developmental courses are paying tuition for those courses. So that is, each student pays tuition per credit for those courses. So the estimate that we made of approximately $6 million in tuition supporting developmental courses for recent high school graduates is coming from those students in the courses. The other portion is, there's not a specific allocation to developmental courses. We have an allocation model that distributes the state appropriation that comes to the system to institutions on the basis of their enrollment, their programming, their costs of providing instruction, and those costs for the developmental courses would be incorporated into the data that are used to determine the allocation to each institution.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, may I just, I'm sorry, I know we have to get going.
Yes.
I do feel that this is such a critical piece that you have uncovered, and I was very excited that Brunick said the other day that in the next teacher partnership, he said, we need to improve accountability to the state. We sure do, and we need to improve accountability to these students, particularly those that go into college and pay additional funds to get remediation after we have spent the kind of money we spend in this state to our high schools. I think it's really very sad and very concerned, and very often, I would, to Representative Mariani's point, be interesting to know if this extra tuition is being borne on the backs of our students that can least afford it. So I think that what you've uncovered today is excellent. I want to thank you for your report. I want to thank the gentleman that brought this out. But I think we need a public record of what schools are not getting their students ready. And if the public saw this, I think they would be shocked.
Representative Myra, last question.
I will pass so we can get to the bills.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, and I'm sure members would you know, be grateful if you would stick around, if you can, for questions they might have after we hear these next two bills. Representative Barrett. Members, we have two bills today that deal with the repeal of the January 15th collective bargaining agreement deadline and aid penalty. And Representative Barrett is going to lead off with House File 115. Welcome to the table, Representative Barrett. Introduce yourself and then please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Barrett, Representative Bob Barrett, representing the good people of Chisago County. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 115 for the committee's consideration.
Representative Barrett moves House File 115, and members, we will be re-referring this to K-12 Finance. Representative Barrett, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will briefly explain my bill. Then I have two people that would like to have give testimony on the bill. But let me briefly describe it so that we can, as much as I guess a politician can say anything briefly, but I will do my best. House File 115 repeals the current statute, 123B.05, that has a January 15th deadline and penalty on school districts who don't reach a contract settlement with the teachers' union. You have a sheet of paper that has been presented to each member of the committee. I won't go over that other than to highlight a particular word, and that is what I believe to be a distorted bargaining process. The deadline and the penalty are related to one part of a two-party situation, and I think that a repeal is necessary so that both parties can have the same set of rules. Rather than go into the details, and I'd be open to questions, but I'd like to give an analogy that might represent my point. I have two daughters. They are teenagers now, 17 and 15, Elizabeth and Hannah. When they were younger, they had a bedtime. Their bedtime was anywhere from 8 to 10 o'clock as they got older. So imagine a situation in which both daughters had a bedtime, and they both had to be in bed at the same time. And if they didn't both be in bed at the same time, there was a problem. Imagine a situation where my daughter Elizabeth was relieved of part of her allowance. Let's say I took $5 away every night that she and her daughter Hannah did not get into bed at 10 o'clock. Now, it didn't matter in her situation. It wouldn't matter if she was in bed and Hannah wasn't. Elizabeth would still get penalized the $5. But Elizabeth can only control herself. She can't control Hannah. So I would argue that this situation in which Hannah and Elizabeth, or Elizabeth is penalized for the actions of Hannah, would not be appropriate. And I think this is a good analogy for this bill. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mike McLaughlin. Mike is superintendent of Chisago Lakes School District.
Welcome to the committee, Superintendent. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm the superintendent of schools at the Chisago Lakes Public Schools in Lindstrom, Minnesota. I've been a superintendent in Minnesota for 14 years, the last six of which have been at Chisago Lakes. We enroll about 3,400 students, just about 40 minutes north of St. Paul here. I've been involved in teacher contract negotiations in three different school districts across Minnesota over the course of my career. I've participated in the teacher contract negotiation process when there has been a penalty to the school district for not settling contracts prior to January 15th, as well as when the penalty to school districts was removed temporarily by legislative action. While the intent of the current law, in my opinion, holds merit in that it expedites the negotiation process and forces parties to meet and negotiate in a timely manner, I feel it has also had a negative effect on school districts by forcing them, in many cases, to settle contracts that proved to be too expensive for districts to sustain solely out of the fear of the financial penalty, and forces the financial penalties on the district only in the event that the negotiating parties fail to come to an agreement. During the negotiation process, the penalty is usually discussed as a negative bargaining point with the union, which implies or threatens additional cuts to union staff and school programs if it is imposed on the district by the state. It also threatens the district with the loss of already scarce resources if the district chooses to not settle for an early unsatisfactory agreement. The penalty threat rarely improves the offer the district makes to the bargaining unit. The penalty threat often causes a misunderstanding in the community that the school district is willing to waste money by not settling, when in actuality the district is attempting to save money for the community by not agreeing to unrealistic long-term financial obligations that easily outweigh the penalty dollar amount, and also which cannot be sustained by the district in the long term. The district lives with the consequences of a less than desirable settlement, not just for the 2 years of the contract, but forever. Speaking as a member of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, our organization has developed a platform position regarding the repeal of Minnesota Statutes 2010-123B.05 that we believe is in the best interest of students, school districts, and our valued educators in the state of Minnesota. As such, we as an organization urge the repeal of this statute. As a practicing school superintendent in a suburban school district facing many challenges related to school finances and contract negotiations, I urge the legislature to remove the statute that binds the hands of school boards across the state during teacher negotiations and accomplishes little in the way of providing fair and equitable salary and benefit contracts for the many deserving educational professionals in our employ. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony this morning, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Representative Baird, do you have others to testify?
I do. Before I do, I'd just like to add a little bit to what the Superintendent just said. You may hear testimony today against the repeal of the January 15th deadline, because the thought may be that it forces both parties to come together with realistic offers. It does not. It only forces one of the two parties to come together with a realistic offer. You may also hear testimony that keeping the January 15th deadline is good for kids. It's not good for kids. It pushes school districts, as Mike had said, to sign a contract they cannot afford, which is directly related to teacher layoffs later in the year. You also may hear that keeping the January 15th deadline provides for more local control. It does not. Eliminating a state mandate increases local control. You also may hear that the $25 fine per student actually reduces the amount of money available to teachers in the final contract settlement. It does not. Most contracts are settled right before the deadline, when one of the two parties has maximum control over the negotiating process. With that, I would like to ask that Brad Lindell step forward.
While he's coming to the table, Representative Mariani, you have a question for the superintendent.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Superintendent, good morning and welcome to the committee. I have the utmost respect for the leaders of our school district all over the state. I'm glad you're here. Let me ask you this, and this is an honest question of just sort of struggling with the pros and cons of this. The data that I have shows that during implementation of this mandate, if you will, that settlements are pretty high. And in fact, when we've waived them during those periods of time, that it's gone in the opposite direction. So clearly, given your testimony in terms of your concern of the cost, how do you balance out the value of a prompt and early settlement versus the concern you have about a as you testified, a potential increased cost relative to that settlement, because clearly there are also costs that are involved when there isn't a settlement, and those may be, I imagine, financial, but they also could be, you know, issues of morale, the ability to make proper assignments at a proper time, etc. So maybe just, you know, quickly kind of help us think how you weigh those two things out.
Superintendent McLaughlin.
Chairman Erickson, Representative Mariani, in my limited experience, I have not found the deadline necessarily to be a positive factor in either school morale, in regard to employee satisfaction with how the process is going, frustration with what the district is able to offer or what have you. But what I think is really unique in this particular bargaining cycle coming up with the large deficit that the state legislature is looking at and the reality that districts are going to be strapped for finances, that to actually have this arbitrary deadline that needs to be met in a time when there's no dollars, I just see that being a aligning of planets for some definite negativity in the schools. It's tough for me to necessarily comment on past settlements in regard, because we've actually always met the deadline. We have, in fact, gone to mediation in preparation for not meeting the deadline, but were successful in 11th-hour mediations. But I think you raise a very good point in regard to morale and in regard to that balancing that school boards across the state need to look at when attempting to do a fair contract with deserving employees.
Thank you.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent. Thank you for coming down today. Between 2005 and 2009, only 51% of Chisago Lakes High School graduates went on to public or to higher education at a public institution in Minnesota. And of those, 19% required remedial education. They weren't prepared for college courses. How will the repeal of the January 15th deadline help Chisago Lakes better prepare more students for college and better prepare those students for the college demands?
Superintendent.
Madam Chairman, Representative, I'd have to give that some pretty good thought, to be candid with you. I believe we employ excellent educators at Chisago Lakes. I think the testimony that you heard this morning from our colleagues in higher ed is a very complicated one, and I do believe that some of the statements that were made by the other gentleman whose testimony spoke to some of the districts as rural districts, a lot smaller than suburban districts, less mobility, less challenges in regard to racial diversity and socioeconomic challenges. I think that those all factor into the issue a lot more than what particular teacher at Chisago Lakes High School has been successful in math or what have you. I tell you what we are struggling with at Chisago Lakes right now is the mandate to make certain that algebra is completed by students by eighth grade. That has been a very interesting challenge to be met in the public schools. As you know, algebra will no longer be awarded a high school credit. And for all of us in the room, when we attended high school, that algebra and algebra 2, frankly, were part of the program. So there's a real compressing of our curriculum and a ramping up of our instruction. And there's some fear there that some concepts may be getting missed in an effort to try and make this deadline of making sure that all of our eighth graders have had algebra before they reach high school. So it's a very complicated topic, and I don't claim to have the insight that our colleagues have presented this morning in regard to the challenges that higher ed have. I wish I could enlighten you a little bit more in that regard, but I don't think I can.
Thank you.
Mr. Lundell, would you say your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell for Schools for Equity and Education, and I'll be very brief. I can't say it any better than Superintendent McLaughlin has said. I think it's and this the summary of the bill puts it very succinctly. It's a distorted bargaining process that we have in place right now, and it's I think that given the it's not a, teaching and in management and education is not a pure labor market as it is because you have to be licensed to teach. And there's a difficulty to get a replacement if a strike were to take place. But I think that this has made the bargaining process even more difficult for school districts. And repealing it, I think, is something that should be done. And I can stand for questions. I've talked to the Brainerd folks who lost $200,000 last year. And their experience is similar to what Superintendent McLaughlin has said. They simply weren't going to settle something that was going to, you know, cause problems down the road. I think that the other thing I would add is that even if you say you're a percent or two above where the school district can afford, over time that compounds. And so when people talk about losing opportunities, that's going to compound over time. And especially the districts that I represent are low property wealth, have dip property wealth, have difficulty passing referendums. We don't do well on state formulas. It's just more difficult for our districts because we just don't have the wiggle room that some other districts do have. Not to say that any district in the state has a lot of wiggle room right now. But I think that the problems that we have in places like Chisago Lakes are exacerbated by this policy, and we certainly would like to see it repealed.
Representative Barrett, other testifiers?
I have two testifiers, and then I think Representative Downey will have some testifiers
okay.
as well.
Is there anyone who wants to speak? Oh, Representative Greiling, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I need Mr. Lundell again. Sorry. Madam Chair, Mr. Lundell, am I right that C would also, another position of C is to have September 1st be a change in the date?
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, Representative Grant, September 1st in terms of starting school?
Mr. Lundell, no, in terms of changing the January 15th date to September 1st.
Mr. Lundell.
As another fallback. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Representative Dreiling, we haven't really talked about that in any specificity, so I can't really give you an answer on that.
Thank you. I might have bad information. Thank you.
Ms. Allswiger, are you ready to present the other side of the story? Welcome to the committee, and say your name for the record and present your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. I was actually hoping I could actually test against Representative Downey instead of a freshman here, but in a
you're welcome to
very
return.
Collaborative fashion, of course. I want to go on record that Education Minnesota opposes the repeal of the January 15th contract settlement deadline. And you have some documents in front of you. I will explain those in a moment. But we do believe that January 15th has resulted in far more collaborative negotiations. It's resulted in earlier settlements. You know, this, I just want to remind you, some of you might be very well aware of this, but in March they will start negotiating the contract between the district and the teachers. And then by January 15th they need to be done, because we have a January 15th deadline. But when we did not have the January 15th deadline, that bargaining would drag on and on, sometimes for 2 years. It would drag on for 2 years. But as a result of January 15th deadline, it has focused the work on the negotiations in the summer. In the spring, the district and the union would get ready, have some beginning discussions, and in the summer they really focused and got their work done. You know what it did? And Education Minnesota was part of this. The old MEA and the old MFT were part of this too. We started training our members on interest-based bargaining. Remember the book Getting to Yes? So that there were fewer confrontational bargainings. I actually had the opportunity to sit on them. It was wonderful. When January 15th came into play, we started seeing settlements in November, October, September. And after a few cycles, we would hear and we would see districts and unions coming together and saying, we're going to be done before school starts. And then when the teachers came back, they would vote and they'd ratify the contract. It used to be, when you don't have the January 15th deadline, you know what they do? They wait, the districts and the teachers, they wait until they see what your kind of money you're giving them. And it prolongs it and prolongs it, and actually puts more pressure on you, I think. Both parties work together, and both parties are impacted. We just don't agree that districts are the ones that have difficulty negotiations. Hey, you talk to some of those school board members, those administrators. They're tough people. They're good people. And both parties want to get things done. Look at the charts. I would ask you to take a look at the document that has the bar graph. And this illustrates what I'm talking about. What this data doesn't show on the high bars, that's when you don't have the January 15th, those are the number or the percentage that have not settled. What we don't say here is how long it takes to settle that contract. We are now going into a new round of bargaining, and I can guarantee you we would have a number of districts that weren't settled if we didn't have the January 15th contract settlement deadline. Which gets to my next point. Deadlines get things done. And I do appreciate Representative Barrett's comment about his daughters. It's kind of funny. I was going to talk about my daughter. My daughter, by 8 o'clock tonight, she has to have about 5 things done. And then she will either, you know, get a reward or there will probably be a consequence. But everybody is different when it comes to your age and your ability. But that's different than the districts, we believe. Think about your job. Now, some of the freshmen haven't had the great opportunity to come up against committee deadlines, but you know how you scramble to get things done for the first deadline, the second deadline, and ultimately that last deadline. And people work very hard, and you have to come together. And there are only, you know, there's the House and the Senate. So it's the same, basically, as the, and there's the Republicans and the Democrats in both bodies. So you've got a similar situation. Teachers have made, historic sacrifices over the last number of years. And January 15th has not created a windfall for teachers. It has not resulted in huge salary settlements. It has not given them the upper hand in bargaining. The average teacher salary in Minnesota in 2009 increased by $17. Those are MDE, the Department of Education figures. There are a record number of locals that took freezes. Our staff has gone through the contracts, and she's about two-thirds of the way. 10% of them took hard freezes with a January 15th contract settlement deadline. Now, I don't know where it ends up with the last third, but about 10% have. That means no steps, no lanes, no improvement in the salary schedule. Minnesota's teachers rank in pay compared to the rest of the country. We've gone from, in 2005 to 2009, 4 years, from 16th to 20th. This is my 17th session. I believe when I started in 95 that we were number 8. We're close to it. I also want to share with you how it has impacted the collaborative workings of the negotiations process. We see fewer strikes. You've got a document that shows where the strikes are. When were those strikes? And we don't have January 15th contract settlement or delay as a result of it. Then there's another document related to the statistics. I just talked to you about the $17 increase from MDE. And you might say, well, this chart looks a little different. I want to explain something. When you get the settlement numbers from Education Minnesota or from the School Boards Association, MSBA, those are projected costs. The settlement numbers on this sheet, and I'll describe the sheet in a moment, are projected costs. They're a snapshot in time. It says that if your staff today stays in place and we give an increase, this is what your increase in salary will be. What it doesn't take into effect is that we have retirees, we have retirements, we have layoffs, we have change in staffing, and as a result, that number after the fact is the $17 increase average from the Department of Education.
Thank you, Ms. Elswager. We have to vote on this bill at quarter two, so do you have just a closing statement to make, please?
I would just have you look at the document, the third document. And in September, this is for the second column and the third column are the increases for the first year of the contract and the second year of the contract. In September, we're seeing 1.78. By the time we get to January 15th, it's 0.075, and these are accumulative. This shows that the settlements are not getting higher. They're actually getting lower as we get closer to the 15th. So this is not a burden on the state. We think this focuses on collaboration. And we would just like to focus more time on teaching rather than waiting and not getting things done. Just a solution that you could think about. Have an incentive if you get done by a certain time. I realize that's probably not going to happen in these budget times. Or, as Representative Barrett talked about a different time, maybe you move it up until October 1st. We could support that. October 15th probably is a little more realistic. So,
Representative Mariani, is your question for Ms. Elswager?
Very quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Elswager, I get this, and that's why I pulled out that information about the data where the settlements, and it seems to me that there's a value to that. What does bug me is that school districts, when they are penalized, wind up giving money back to the general fund. And, you know, is there a different way to do this? Is there another creative way to still set a deadline that has some kind of an enforcement period or some kind of enforcement mechanism other than school districts giving money back to the general fund that we're going to spend on anything but education?
Ms. Salzweiger.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, you know, we've talked about this for a number of years, and the two solutions that I came up with, and one being an incentive, is the one that most people kind of buy into, but, you know, that costs something. So, by keeping this in place, it's actually is negative for your fixing your budget deficit, because there's a cost to this. Now, I'm not saying that's good, because we don't want any districts to have a penalty and put the money back in the general fund. But this actually hurts the budget deficit. So I just want to make you aware of that.
Representative Grylin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allswiger, now that Representative Dabney has helped me to read my information, it's actually MASBO, the business managers, that have the position for the September 1st deadline. And I'm wondering if Ed Minnesota has changed their position on that with... Given, I know that you were flexible with the deadline, but you didn't like September 1st because it was teachers are gone in the summer and so forth. But I'm wondering, with technology and, you know, much heightened means of communication and so forth, if you have changed and would be more flexible with that being a middle ground, September 1st.
Ms. Salzweiger.
Madam Chair and Representative Grylin, because of the, depending on the start of the year, you know, I think that there might be some possibilities there, and we have opposed that in the past because we felt like we needed a little bit more time. Sometimes it's more for cleanup than anything else and making sure that people are educated about what's happening. So I'm certainly more than willing to take this back to our organization and see what they would say about it, but earlier certainly makes some sense to a certain degree.
Representative Baird, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I know we don't have time to go over the details of what we just heard, but just want to comment on a couple points. We don't have a January 15th deadline. School districts have a January 15th deadline. I think that's a very important point and one of the main points of my argument for repeal. Minneapolis just settled after a year and paid a heavy fine. So the January 15th deadline did not do much to promote a more urgent settlement date. Also, while there is a negative fiscal note to the state, there would be, if we did fiscal notes for school districts, it would be a positive fiscal note for school districts, which when you get back to the kids and what's best for the kids, I think is very important. So in closing, I'd just like to say, many of you might know, I'm a high school certified basketball umpire, basketball referee, baseball and softball umpire. And so when I do that, I wear a jersey, or I wear a shirt. And the shirt here, right here, it signifies a person who wants to apply rules fairly to everyone. Now, a lot of parents and I've officiated in the past, and coaches would argue that those rules are presented fairly, but the attempt is to apply rules fairly to everyone. And so in that process, I have different rules that I have to follow. So we have a pretty significant softball rules book. 100 and some pages. The rules here have to be applied to both teams fairly, equally. This rule book is a baseball rule book. Again, same situation. As an official, I need to apply this rule book fairly to both sides. Basketball rule book, same thing. Study the rules, know them, apply them. Can you imagine what would happen if I, as an official, went in and said, you know what, Team A, we have five fouls, but once you get five fouls, you're going to be kicked out. But Team B, you know, you get five fouls and you can stay in the game. No problem. Now, Team A might argue that that might penalize Team A because Team B, the player might get a little bit more exhausted at the end of the game even though he's continuing to play. That's not the case. Rules have to be applied fairly, which is what this repeal is about. So I would urge your passage. I would also ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Barrett renews his motion that House File 115 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance, and he's requested a roll call. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Erickson.
Yes.
Representative Depke.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
No.
Representative Barrett.
Aye.
Representative Benson.
Pass.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Crawford.
Yes.
Representative Dabney.
No.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Kath.
No.
Representative Kiefer.
Yes.
Representative Keel.
Yes.
Representative McFarland.
Yes.
Representative Moran.
No.
Representative Murdoch.
Yes.
Representative Myra.
Yes.
Representative Norton.
Pass.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Representative Brandon Peterson.
Oh, no.
He's absent. Mm-hmm. Representative Sandra Peterson.
No, I'm sorry.
Representative.
Two votes.
Yeah, the both of those votes count.
Representative Woodard.
No, I mean, yes.
Aye.
Can't take first
vote. The Petersons are driving us insane.
You had two members of the past. Representative Norton, Representative Benson.
Yeah. Representative Norton.
I'm going to abstain.
Representative Benson.
No.
Madam Speaker?
Yes, Representative Norton.
Mr. Chairman? You know, I'm very frustrated with this because I actually think there's lots of room for discussion. I had questions, and so I'm abstaining because I really needed a little more time on this. And
we have
I
Representative Downey up next, so please ask him.
And well, but that
same bill
didn't help me on this vote, so I just wanted to share that.
Yes, the report is there are 11 ayes, 8 noes, and 1 abstention. The bill is passed and referred to K-12 Finance. Representative Downey.
That was cute.
And Representative Keel, would you move House File 92 for Representative Downey?
Yes, I will move that.
Representative Keel moves House File 92. On behalf of Representative Downey, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Representative Downey, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing my bill. It is an exact duplicate of Representative Barrett's bill. We both introduced roughly the same bill at the same time, so I appreciate you hearing this as well and anticipate this also moving on to K-12 Finance. We will try to go fast. We're under a tight schedule here. What I wanted to do, and maybe if I would, I'll invite the testifiers that were going to testify on my bill to come down. I want to just put a little bit of a personal face, a case study face to this bill. We've been talking about kind of the policy dimensions and broad statistics. My district, Edina, has had a many decades-long love affair with its teachers in its school district. My father taught with Representative Benson in the Edina schools, and we just have a wonderful tradition of great education and an incredibly great relationship between the community and our schools and our teachers. And one of the unintended consequences of what I think is a one-sided penalty, and I won't go through the previous discussion, but just to lay out what happened in my community and what I think the end result of that has been, and then to hear from some other folks similarly. My district reached a tentative agreement with the negotiators in September of 2009. That settlement was rejected by the teachers. In December of 2009, the district reached a second tentative agreement with the negotiators, which was similarly in January rejected by the membership at large. We incurred a $230,000 penalty as a result of that and ultimately settled for roughly the exact same contract that was rejected in January, very shortly thereafter in March. And so the assumption that this deadline somehow protects and facilitates good faith negotiations I don't think is true in this case. In fact, it penalized good faith negotiation in a tough time. Negotiations are always tough. This deadline, I think, in terms of its one-sided penalty, puts too much of the leverage on the side of one party versus the other. But here's the really unfortunate part of this. Negotiations are tough. Oftentimes, hopefully, the community and the kids are protected from that. There's a time when that probably needs to be exposed, that the transparency is helpful. But when the district sends out a letter explaining to parents in the community why we suffered a $230,000 penalty, and the union responds, all of a sudden, something that is designed to protect good process within the collective bargaining activity has pitted parents versus the district versus teachers, and frankly, kids have gotten involved as well. And I think that's highly unfortunate, and there is a new dimension in my community between the community and its district and its teachers that never existed before as direct result of this penalty. So, members, I'll let the other testifiers explain their stories and their testimony, but for that reason alone, I would be here irrespective of the broader policy implications that I think were fully explored in Representative Barrett's bill.
Mr. Kronquist, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we support Representative Downey and Representative Barrett's bill, and thank them for bringing them forward. I've mentioned this before to many of you. Our board members just failed to understand how we have a law that penalizes students when the adults don't get the job done. Makes sense. And no matter how you slice it or dice it or try to, you know, spin this argument, that's the bottom line. Students get penalized. We had three districts this last go-around that got penalized. Minneapolis was hit with an $800,000 penalty. Edina, as Representative Downey just said, $230,000. St. Cloud, $500,000. Do we really think that the students are benefiting from that in St. Cloud, Edina, and Minneapolis? Or that the teachers are benefiting from that loss of that kind of revenue? I don't see how. Now, if we need to have a deadline, let's have one. But let's have something else than be the consequence. And I agree the deadline should be moved up. Why do we go through half the school year with this hanging over our head? So September 1st, October 1st, I don't have the answer for you. And one example that could kick in if the deadline comes and goes is that both sides agree to submit to arbitration. We do that for other employee groups. Principals do it now. Peace officers do it now. Other essential employees do it now. So I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for
Mr.
your consideration.
Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools. Many of you might have seen that our superintendent has just launched our new strategic plan, which has three focuses. One is closing the achievement gap, aligning our programs, and sustaining our programs. And as you know, we do love tradition in St. Paul, but we are not interested in the traditional methods of balancing and budgeting that cut people in programs, which is basically what we've been doing the last several years. When our superintendent was new last year, her first job was to cut $27 million from our program, and it was very difficult. We closed eight schools. We combined eight schools into other buildings. We, in 2009, we reduced our number of FTEs by 236 people. Those are real jobs, and over the last 10 years, we're down over 1,200 FTEs because of the ongoing budget cuts as the costs have exceeded the revenue that's been available and inflation. So we do believe that this might be one tool that would be helpful. Obviously, we're going to need other tools to be creative and to figure out a way to sustain the programs that we currently operate in the school, but we do support this bill, and our board has included this as part of their legislative agenda.
Mr. Grathwell.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwell with the Minneapolis Public Schools. We support both Representative Downey's bill and Representative Barrett's bill. Thank them for bringing them forward. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can lead management and labor to the bargaining table, but you can't make them settle. Both parties in Minneapolis decided we're fighting over, or negotiating, but fighting over real issues with in good faith, and they took it to the mattresses, and they took that penalty, and we settled our contract. On the margin, we don't think that penalty made a big difference. We were fighting over different issues. It's significant, and I think Mr. Kronquist has the best line, that why would we punish students for when the adults don't get the job done? But there are big and serious issues we're negotiating, and
We think repeal of this penalty and deadline improve our prospects. Thanks very much.
Thank you. In respect to Representative Norton, who had a question earlier, Representative Norton, would you ask your question first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it's a direct question. I'm really struggling here because for a number of reasons. One, I support fair contracts for our teachers, mm-hmm. but I also know the world works under deadline. And so while originally this concept I totally support, and as a former school board member and as a parent who lived through a strike in my district, I've had many opportunities to see this play out in a variety of different ways. Where I'm struggling is if we really cared about kids and we know that we work under deadlines, the deadline should be before school starts so our children are not working, having to feel the impact. There's the impact financially, but there's also the impact of the stress that our staff and our administration are dealing with and the time that our teachers have to take out of the classroom to participate in the bargaining process. So I guess I very much appreciate Mr. Kroonquist's suggestion of a September 1st deadline and forced mediation. Personally, that's where my heart lies. And so I just need to say I'm struggling. I wish we had more time to fix the bill, and perhaps I'll just submit my own version that I could be very supportive of, but I'm afraid we're doing a quick fix to a more complex problem here. So,
Ms. Alzweiger, you wanted to say a word or two?
Madam Chair, I just thought I would officially, Jan Alzweiger, Education Minnesota, I just thought I would go on record to officially oppose this bill. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Madam Chair.
I don't think I need to go any further into detail.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very, very quickly, and to my good friend, Mr. Grathwell, it looks like the data, in fact, over time says that if you do have deadlines, you can't settle. And so that's kind of what we're also struggling with here. But my question is to Representative Downey very, very quickly. Representative Downey, so we heard. You heard my plea earlier in the other bill, and we heard a recommendation from Mr. Kroonquist. Why not structure a bill that says we'll send it to arbitrary, or rather to mandatory arbitration? Why does this have to be an all-or-nothing kind of thing? I mean, it sounds like a creative solution here. We're hearing some good evidence that deadlines do matter. They do count. It is helpful. There are morale issues at stake here In the same breath, many of us who support that are also saying, you know what, I don't like sending money back I don't think the consequence here probably is the best consequence. What about a different consequence? Why not structure your bill to add that element into it? And are you open to doing that down the line?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mariani. Actually, I had that exact bill last year, and I don't believe I don't even know if I requested a hearing given that we had a bigger agenda. But I don't think it would have passed. So this year, starting out with a straight-up repeal, as the dialogue continues and as this bill moves through committee and presumably, hopefully, to the House floor and into negotiations with the governor's office, I think there's an expression of some common ground, and I think that's a good thing. So I believe the committee has done its work, and I'd recommend passage of my bill so that can continue, and I think I would be extremely receptive to discussions about how to actually craft something that can work and actually get passed.
Fair enough. Thank you, Ms.
Yeah. Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 92 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All those in favor, please say yes. Yes. Those opposed, no.
No.
No. The motion does prevail.
Madam Chair, if I may. I would like to call for a division, if I could.
I am going to give the result first. Please, Representative Barrett. The motion does prevail. House File 92 is re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance, and this meeting is adjourned.